Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 10th, 2008. I'm James Spencer.
I'm Steve Wilkes.
Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, our coverage of the National Homebrewers Conference in Cincinnati continues on.
There's more?
There's more.
Oh, no.
With part two of our wrap-up of the sessions that we went to and the interviews with the experts that we got to talk to. And this week, Steve and I will take you through more interviews with experts that we got at the conference. So, if you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow us on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word, and you are?
Braggot.
Braggot.
All one word.
Braggot. And when Twitter's working, sometimes Twitter doesn't work.
It gets overwhelmed a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's a little neurotic.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Twitter's busy. So, we got a lot to cover this week.
Well, we do. There's good stuff, too.
We didn't get to record, you know, the experts from every conference session for one reason or another. But there was a ton of information there that we were able to gather. And Friday morning, we got to talk to Anthony Hayes from England.
Mm-hmm. Actually from South Africa.
Oh, that's right.
He's living in England.
From South Africa by way of England.
He's one of the Queen's subjects.
That's right.
wherever the heck he's living these days.
He doesn't talk like us.
No, so he doesn't. All British people sound smarter than me. It doesn't matter. You know?
Most Americans sound smarter than me.
Well,
But Ant talked about beer styles from an English homebrew perspective, mm-hmm. and we nabbed him after his presentation. Ant Hayes, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio. We appreciate your presentation. You're brave to be early this morning on your presentation.
I'd like to get it over so I can start drinking earlier.
What do you think are the key points of the differences between the philosophies of British homebrewing and American homebrewing?
I think the main thing is that English beers tend to be a bit understated and a little bit more balanced, whereas I think the American beers are great about being very expressive and going really pushing style boundaries. So space for both types of beers, but England will be a little bit more restrained, as I think we are. American is exuberant.
that's an appropriate adjective. But American brewers have really pushed especially the IPA style, the India Pale Ale style. What do the English think of what's happening to that style?
Well, I think the biggest request I've had is to bring a few bottles home. Traditional IPA is always fairly hoppy, but not nearly as hoppy as the American versions. I think people recognize the American version is a new style, and it's great. It really brings out the hop. You know, we like our hops, and it's a great beer to drink. It's not a session beer. You won't sit in a pub and drink five pints, but, you know, on a cold night, they're delightful, and, I'm a big fan.
Yeah, the traditional, in looking at your charts, the traditional IPA, English IPA, was around 1060 gravity, right? Which to us is just a session beer nowadays.
Yeah, I think the style that I had there is not quite, it was slightly more modern traditional. The really old IPAs were a lot stronger, but those are the ones that were exported to India. When they launched them in Great Britain, as it was then, they dropped the gravities. So we didn't ever really get the traditional IPAs in England. Only with expats in India got it. So that's where our styles are. If an Englishman wants to brew a really traditional IPA, he'll go higher than those guidelines I put up on the screen.
So Steve and I are interested in getting more into the session beers, into the weaker gravity beers. But you say that even though they're lower in gravity, they're quite satisfying. What are the keys to doing a lower gravity beer without it being watery and unsatisfying?
I think the key thing is malt selection. The malt that that we prefer is what's known as floor malted Maris Otter, which is a very flavorful malt. So you can have hardly any of it in your beer at all, but it brings nutty and caramel sort of flavors. So that's the big driver. If you brew a low-gravity beer with a sort of more commercial industrial malt, you're going to get water. If you use the traditional malt, the flavor just jumps out at you, and you don't need to have the alcohol. So that's the key thing. Low alpha hops are also important. If you use a high alpha hop, you start getting flavors that will then overpower your malt, whereas the low alpha traditional sort of Fuggles, East Kent Goldings, they meld nicely with the flavors from the malt, and you get the more rounded beer. And then finally is get the right yeast. You know, if you get the traditional English yeasts, which are widely available here now, Nottingham, for example, they really lend themselves to low-gravity beers, and they leave a lot behind, if you know what I mean, in terms of flavor. They don't take all the flavor out in the fermentation. So that's a lot of answers, but that's what you have to do. And be patient and be subtle. It takes a while to fine-tune your recipe.
And what about the mash temperatures?
Oh, I'm not going to get the Fahrenheit. We tend to mash those around about 67, which is I think is about 160, maybe 158, somewhere around there. It's a little bit higher than normal mash, but not a lot higher.
Yeah. And specialty grains, is the Maris Otter enough, or do you have to?
Maris Otter is enough. You get the right. That's the surprising thing about it, because again, you're wanting to get as much flavor with your with your alcohol, and the Maris Otter tends to do it. It might throw in a little bit, but what will tend to happen then is it'll overwhelm the subtle flavors, and you'll get a one-dimensional beer, which session beer is not. So, they're very simple recipes in that sense. So it'll be Maris Otter and say Fuggles, and that's all that goes in it. But you get the right proportions, and you get the right yeast, and then it comes right.
Yeah, that was the question I had. You actually just answered that. It sounds like it's about simplicity and being kind of straightforward and subtle, to use your word. And that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like Italian cooking. I the first time I went to Italy, I found the food bland because I was used to, the way my mother cooks, where she throws in lots of everything.
Yeah.
But after you've been there a while, you pick up the subtlety. And I think it's the same with English beer. Your first impression will be that it's watery. But after a while, your tongue kind of gets used to picking out the more subtle flavors, and what then happens is you taste an American beer and it blows your head off, which is very nice.
It's very nice, but three IPAs from, say, Avery will knock you down.
Yeah, then you'll stand up again.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I thought it was the most interesting thing that I took away from Ant's presentation was that the we can label styles like an English mild or an English IPA, and he compared our definition of those styles against their definition of the styles, and they're different.
Mm-hmm. They are different, and it seemed to me that the English way of thinking about it, or the UK way of thinking about it, is somewhat, I don't want to say fuzzier, but they don't seem to be as hung up. Mm-hmm. On nailing down exactly the kind of hop and exactly the original gravity and exactly the boiling temperature. You know, a mild is a mild is a mild, and they might be different from city to city and pub to pub when you go across the pond. So I thought that was very interesting and kind of refreshing, actually.
And it was also interesting. He was talking about the fact that the English styles are starting to be affected by our interpretations. So in other words, a lot of the English home brewers are starting to do what we're doing over here, which if you're a purist and you want to kind of hang on to the English brewing culture, I would imagine that would be an intimidating thing.
Well, I think so, but maybe it's generational, perhaps. I don't think I'm going to be very articulate about this, but it just seems to me that you kind of had this old tradition of a brewery or a small, house in a small town in the English countryside that's brewing a particular kind of beer that they call mild.
Mm-hmm.
And here we Americans come with all of our rules and regulations and boxes to put things in, and that we tend to make things a little bigger and, we're America, so we're big and bold and brash. And that's going to change some things, as it does elsewhere culturally in the world. So that's a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, I think experimentation and pushing the envelope is excellent, but on the other side of the fence, I think it's important that we also have the old beers in the archives so that we can not lose anything as we gain the new things.
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to our next session on Friday that we went to. We kind of split up here. You went to a mead session, and I went to a session with Greg Doss from Y-East called Brettanomyces, Comparing Two Strains and Different Ways to Use Them in the Fermentation Process. So we caught up with Greg after his presentation. Well, Greg, thanks for talking to us, and thanks for the talk. It was really interesting.
Yeah, no problem. It's something that we've been playing around with.
So, you know, a lot of people are afraid of Brettanomyces, but you say don't fear the Brett.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what we found and what we know is that with good sanitation techniques using chemicals, heat, there's really not that much to be afraid of. Now, if you don't, then you can have some problems down the road. The other thing is to look at, look for cracks. Don't use plastic or plastic that you want to reuse again. But if you're using you know, good sanitation techniques, it dies just like everything else.
So it's not a spirit that will haunt your brew house forever.
Well, hopefully not.
Talk about your experiment. What are the parameters? What are the variables that you guys were looking at?
And so when we looked at putting this experiment together, we looked at all the variables involved, and there's we came up with about 9 of them. And unfortunately, I don't have the list in front of me right now, but it involved looking at temperature, the grist, the mass, the mash, the pH, O2, the Brett strains, different Brett strains you could use. And it was overwhelming how many ways we could go with this. And so what we did is we pared it down to kind of the fundamental question is, how do you actually use it? When do you inoculate it? And so we ran 3 different procedures. One we looked at inoculating all Brett. Secondly, we looked at primary with a Saccharomyces strain, secondary with a Brett. And then we also looked at co-inoculating Brett and Saccharomyces at the same time. What we ended up kind of stumbling in as a secondary project was the use of different Saccharomyces strains and how that interacts with the Brett, and we were actually able to find out some interesting stuff.
So what were the Saccharomyces strains that you used, and what did you find between those?
Well, what we started with, we started our first set of fermentations. We ran with 1007, which is our German alt strain, and we initially recognized that we weren't getting the Brett character that we were anticipating and what we see when we run these fermentations at home. So for the next 2 sets of tests, we added a couple other Saccharomyces strains. So we added our 1056, which is the American ale, fairly standard ale yeast. And then we also ran the 3787, which is a Trappist high gravity yeast. And it's actually one of probably my favorite yeast, at least right now, that I've been using a lot at home and for a lot of these fermentations. And we were definitely able to pick up more horse character or more Brett character out of the 1056 and even more so out of the 3787 fermentations. And I don't have any I've got some theories on why that happened, but not necessarily any hard research and hard data.
And that's an interesting thing is that you know, the people are starting to use this stuff, and you guys are selling it, but there's so much that's not known.
Absolutely, and that's really what I found when we started this project. I interviewed a lot of home brewers and a lot of commercial brewers as well, and everybody's kind of at the same spot. And I feel that there's not a lot known about how these bugs work and how to use them. People tend to go on of, well, I did this last time and it came up with this. And I'm going to do that again. But when you look at how advanced everybody is with Saccharomyces fermentations and manipulating pitch rates and O2 and temperatures and every other variable you can figure out to get exactly what you want, we're nowhere near that. And so That was really one of the goals of this presentation, is to get some interest in this and hopefully kind of a grassroots effort to get the homebrewers able to get some of this information, and hopefully we can organize it a little bit.
And what did you see between adding Brettanomyces in the primary with the Saccharomyces and then adding it in the secondary?
What we found is the Brett production was actually a little bit slower when we co-inoculated. And you got to remember, this is one test, you know, one experiment, one test. We can't base everything off of this. It's a direction to go, but further needs to be done. But what we found is with the co-inoculation, the Brett character came in a little bit slower and not as intense and not as nice and balanced. When we... my theory is that you've got some kind of competition, possibly CO2 inhibiting the Brett, maybe knocking it back a little bit, making it a little more, less healthy than when we ran the inoculating into the secondary, primary with the Saccharomyces and secondary with the Brett. We had a faster Brett character development and more balanced, nicer, it was the preferred sample that we ran.
This is a lot of fun. I appreciate your time.
All right. Well, thanks, James.
Thanks, Greg.
I think it's extremely interesting that Brettanomyces, and getting, you know, we're getting into experimenting with Brettanomyces, and some homebrewers apparently know just as much, if not more, about these bugs, these new bugs, than the actual people who are selling it commercially. I mean, the Y yeast folks, Michael Tonsmeyer was mentioned,
the mad fermentationist.
That's right.
You owe me a Coke.
Michael Tonsmeyer was mentioned in Greg's presentation as a resource.
Yeah.
As a source for some of this information, because Michael's probably playing more with these bugs than they are.
Oh, I tell you, I got to give a shout out to Michael right now, because he is one of the most knowledgeable brewers and most interesting brewers I've ever run across. I just cannot tell you how much I admire what he does and what a great guy he is.
Yeah, and how wonderful it is that we get his beers.
Oh, yeah. You see, I was actually, Michael, I was just sucking up for,
good job.
For the next
good
thing.
Job. Good
job.
But anyway, it's extremely interesting that that Brettanomyces works differently whether you pair it with different strains of Saccharomyces, and whether you add it in the primary fermentation or in the secondary fermentation. So, yep. We are just on the forefront of all the information that's going to come about brewing with Brett, and it's really exciting to hear about all this stuff and to, you know, think about playing with it ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to an interview that you did. Again, we split up, and you got to talk to Ken Schramm, and the title of his presentation was Using Fruit and Spice to Create Balance in Mead.
And what a great – he let us sample a couple of his meads. Heart of Darkness, Oh My Stars, you've just never had anything quite so good in your life. I'm here with Ken Schramm at the American Homebrewers National Conference, the largest one that's ever been had, and I just attended a wonderful session on mead making, particularly focused on how to use spices and fruits. Ken, I really appreciated what you had to say, especially about balance. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there were two parts of the balance picture that we were looking at. We were looking at the concept of creating balanced recipes, and we were also looking at the concept of balance in your life, finding a way to integrate the production of really high-quality fruits into a life that is pleasurable.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I was really struck at how much fruit you use. 35 pounds of cherries, or eight, you know, and just these giant amounts of fruit. And I was having a hard time getting my mind around the volume that was involved.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that much fruit?
Well, actually, this year I would say would be bulging fermenters is the best description of how you deal with that much fruit. I was using an 8-gallon fermenter and nearly blew the lid off of it. I'm probably going to end up having to move to a 10-gallon fermenter to produce a 5-gallon mead because so much of the volume that's in the fermenter is fruit solids. I'm freezing the fruits that I need to freeze to get to my production date and using those fruits that I can that are produced and then fresh, adding them to the fermenter, make sure I get the other fruits thawed, and I'm essentially using a basic wine production technique of fermenting the whole fruit with the honey and then free running off of that to get my liquid volume.
One of the wines, I mean wines, they're so...
Well, they are wines.
Yeah, they are wines.
Perfectly acceptable.
One of the meads that we drank or that we were allowed to taste was a Heart of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful mead, and I wondered if you would describe it a little bit for our listeners, and then also give me a timeline. When did that first go into the fermenter? How many months ago, years ago, on and on?
Well, that was produced with a 2007 fruit crop.
Okay.
So it's less than a year old, and it went into production when the final raspberries that were being used were actually picked, and also when last year's honey crop became available. So it was actually put in the fermenter in I don't have the date in front of me, but I believe it was late October, and then was on the fruit for 28 days, mm-hmm. pretty much a 4-week person.
And what were the fruits that are on it?
There were 18 pounds of cherries and 15 pounds of raspberries, and there were 4 pounds of black currants.
I have to tell you, that was one of the most amazing things I've ever put between my lips.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to reach that sort of involuntary wow from people where they weren't really aware that something that tasted like that could come out of a mead, and that they tasted and without thinking or without any sort of planned reaction, they have that involuntary wow. And if I get that, I really feel like I've succeeded.
Well, you did, and I'm a little jaded.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And finally, you have a book out. Is that not true?
Yes, I do. The Complete Mead Maker was released by Brewers Publications in 2003, and it is available at homebrew stores, on Amazon, and through the Brewers Association website.
That's great. And so now, do you have a website yourself that people can go find stuff out about? Or
no, I don't. I spend most of my online time trying to frequent different home brewing and mead making forums. And so I hang around on gotmead.com and on Wines at Home in the UK and various other places. I've just started posting on Tribe. And if you have a question on mead, look for me at gotmead.com and pose a question to me.
And get the book.
Please.
Listen, Ken, I'd like to invite you to Northwest Arkansas to go fly fishing.
I will accept, and we will determine the dates and times in the future.
Absolutely. Biggest browns on the planet.
That sounds terrific to me.
Okay. We'll see you. Thank you a lot.
Thank you.
Now, you were serious about inviting Ken to fly fish.
Oh, you're not kidding.
In Northwest Arkansas.
I proclaim this to the world, Ken. You got to come down, and you got to check out the smallmouth action on Crooked Creek with me. I'm telling you, and bring mead.
Again, the ulterior motive. But seriously, it would be wonderful to get Ken down here and maybe do like a video podcast with him,
sure.
As well, and you know, learn from the master.
He could straighten me out.
Learn from the master in person. So yeah, the prospect of that is exciting.
Fascinating guy. Glad that we caught up with him. He was off to another meeting there pretty quickly, so we didn't get a lot of time to talk. So maybe we'll get him on the air.
So what was in the next mead that you do? What was the key in his presentation that you took away? I mean, just using so much fruit?
I don't even know where to answer that. I was stunned at the amount of fruit that he used. I think just being not letting it go too dry. I tend to let my meads get too dry, to dry them out too much. And I think just – I think how quickly his meads came done. I mean, I've always thought of meads as taking years. They don't.
Let's move on to Saturday, and you had a gig,
yeah.
So you took off Saturday morning, and I have to give a shout out to a couple of guys that between sessions on Saturday, I checked out of the hotel and I had time to run and get a quick lunch. So I ran to Skyline. Is it Skyline Chili?
Skyline Chili, home of the five-way.
There were... I'm not going to touch that.
Don't touch that.
But there was one just around the corner, and I ran over there, but you know, by myself, and I sat down, and this young guy walked across the restaurant and said, "Hey, James, you know, I listen to your podcast, and you want to eat with me and my dad?" And so I said, "Sure, why not?" And so I ate with Ben and his dad, Bill, and I think Ben lives in upstate New York, and Bill lives in South Carolina. Oh. And they were formerly of Cincinnati, so they filled me in on the chili culture.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati, and the, you know, the proper way to think about Skyline Chili, and so.
Now my daughter lived in Cincinnati for a number of years, and when I called her from Skyline Chili, she was elated, and she told me that she has a wonderful Skyline Chili Cincinnati style recipe. So we're going to make that on the air.
And I met somebody else at the conference who said that he's got a recipe, and I'm still waiting for that. So that's another thing is that this Twitter thing. I'm still not used to the Twitter thing. I went and sat down at the conference at one of the sessions, and the session had just started, and so I didn't have time to talk a lot with. This brewer that I was sitting next to, but he said, "So how was the chili?" Because I had twittered that we were eating chili the day before at Skyline. So he's like, "How's the chili?" And I went, "Huh? How did you know I had chili?"
Are you with the NSA? What's up with this?
Anyway, we digress a little bit, but just talking, you know, that's part of the fun of going to the conference is doing some stuff in the location that you're at and getting some of the local culture.
Oh yeah,
but starting off. On Saturday, which is a heck of a time to start off because it's the morning after club night.
Oh.
So starting off was the brave Ray Daniels talking about the perfect pint, 10 signs of great draft beer, and why you so rarely find them all in one place.
Well, good morning, Ray. You had the tough time spot this morning, but everybody came.
They certainly did. I thought there was going to be about 30 people there. We had 90 or 100. I mean, it was a big room.
So you were talking about the searching for the perfectly served pint of draft beer. Now, what's your impression of a perfectly served pint? Is it a nice frosted glass with lots of ice and foam? And...
You know it's not. No, I mean we've just about dealt the death knell to frosted glasses these days. You know, boy, you see a beautiful beer. It's got a nice cap of foam on the top, probably an inch or so, and it's just beautifully clear. No bubbles adhering to the side of the glass. You know, bubbles stick to the side of the glass. That means the glass isn't clean. There's some dirt there for the bubbles to stick to. Properly clean glass, that's not going to happen. And it's really amazing how rarely that happens, that you get one. And it's so much so that when you do see one, it's like, wow, this is really amazing. I was at the Map Room in Chicago recently, and they poured me, I think it was a Herder Pils that I hadn't had before. And, boy, they put it on the bar, and it's like, man, that is just a beautiful pour. They're really, really doing a great job.
But isn't the bubbles sticking to the side, isn't that the sign of a good beer? Isn't that lacing and the sign of a good head?
The bubbles, the submerged bubbles below the liquid level.
Oh, I see.
Sticking to the side is not good, right, yeah. No, that lacing foam down the side, that's definitely, as you drink, above the liquid level, yeah, that's certainly another sign of a good beer clean glass, well-brewed, well-delivered, well-kept bar.
Now, you introduced us to an interesting trick, which may be a scary trick for those of us at home, but to test if your glasses are clean.
Yep, the salt test. That's a great thing. To test and see if a glass is beer clean. Now, obviously, if it's clean, you know, you can look at it and say, this glass is clean. But you don't know if it's beer clean until you test it. And there's two signs of that without putting a beer in it. One is to rinse it with water, dump the water out, and just check to see how the water adheres to the glass once you've dumped it out. If it spots or runs into patches, there's dirty spots there. If it's not really clear, you're not quite sure, or if it seems to sheet pretty well. Then the next step is to do the salt test. You rinse the glass with water and then take your salt shaker and just shake salt into the glass, you know, up and down the sides. You can, you know, by tilting it, you can get the whole range of the glass. And then hold it up and look and see where the salt sticks, or more specifically, where the salt doesn't stick. All the places that it sticks, that means the water is sheeting there and the glass is clean. If there's some spots that it doesn't stick, then that's a dirty spot and you're having a problem.
So maybe someone's reached inside, or maybe a lipstick, or maybe...
Right. Well, and more typically, and I had one glass that I had left milk in overnight, and then sort of, you know, rinsed vigorously with hot water. And when we did the salt test on that, it was like you're looking like the Mississippi River Delta, all these little fingers of salt, but huge, vast patches of unsalted space.
So how do you get your glasses beer clean?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I haven't quite perfected that at home myself. I'm still doing the no-no, which is washing your beer glasses with all your other dishes. Because, of course, you know, the roast beef and the kids' milk and the cereal bits and so forth, they don't really make for a good beer clean glass. But bar supply places sell proper bar cleaner, glass cleaner, and it's a non-petroleum based detergent, and that's what allows you to get that beer clean thing. The other thing about dishwashers, they've got those the post wash treatments, the
sheeting action.
Yes, exactly,
rinse aid.
Those things. Those are not so good for beer clean as well.
So let's talk about the draft system.
Mm-hmm.
You went into how complex commercial systems are.
Right.
Most of us that have keg systems at home don't have that level of complexity.
Right.
But it was interesting that you were saying that to really get a good system that delivers a nicely poured beer without a bunch of foam, you really need to do some math.
Now, fortunately for homebrew, now if you're using, you're doing standard homebrew, a beer that's got a normal carbonation level of about 2.5 volumes of CO2, that if you're forced carbonating it, you carbonate it to somewhere between 12 and 15 pounds per square inch. You can take a piece of beer hose, this 3/16 internal diameter vinyl hose, a piece that's 4 to 5 feet long will give you the proper resistance to pour your beers, those normally carbonated beers. So that's the simple system. And if you buy a pre-made, you know, beer hose from a place that knows what they're doing, that's what they're going to give you. The connectors on either end and 3/16-inch vinyl hose in the middle. Unfortunately, the experience I related was going into my local homebrew store, and the only beer hose they had was 1/4-inch diameter vinyl hose. And I said to the guy, I says, do you know how many feet of this it takes to, get the proper resistance for a 12 PSI beer? And he looked at me like I was from Mars, of course. And I went home and looked it up, and it takes 14 feet of 1/4-inch internal diameter of vinyl hose to give enough resistance to serve one of those beers properly. So not what you want, and I won't be buying any more beer hose from my local homebrew shop.
So the difference between a 3/16 of an inch inside diameter hose and a 1/4-inch inside diameter hose, it's
right.
Only 1/16
of an inch. But because of we know the relationship between the diameter of a circle and the circumference of a circle, and it's is that a square or a factor? That's a square, isn't it?
It's been
pi
a
r square or two pi r.
It's I thought pi r round.
It's 2 pi r. So it's a factor of 6. So even though that's a small change in internal diameter, it's a much bigger change in the circumference and the overall area. The area would be the pi r squared. So it's a square of the radius. And so even though you're only increasing a little bit, the area increases by the square. And so you're getting a lot more area and much less resistance overall.
So the resistance for a 3/16 of an inch inside diameter vinyl hose is...
Three pounds per foot of tubing. Right. So assuming you've got a 12 PSI beer, you'd need 4 feet. For a 15 PSI, you'd need 5 feet. About 4.5 feet of hose ought to do you pretty good for most situations.
Yeah, that would be frustrating. A lot of people, or I get email every now and then, my beer's foaming, I got a kegging system, what do I do? You know, and
yeah. It is very frustrating. And, you know, one of the other things we talked about is in most homebrew settings, we're not able to hold and control the temperature of the keg and the hose very well. In a commercial draft system, you know, they control that pretty tightly. So all the way up to the faucet, they've got it temperature controlled and held at a steady temperature. Now, if you've got a kegerator at home, you know, you've got a fixed system, you have a little tower on it, that tower is cooled to keep the beer at the desired temperature all the way up. And that's the ideal system. You can really dial that in. You ought to be able to have the perfect pour in that setting. When you just got a keg out at a party, you know, the keg's going to be warming up as it's sitting there, or maybe it's going to be getting colder if you put it in ice and it came out of a 45-degree cooler, whatever. It's a little bit of a bigger challenge. You're going to have to fiddle with it a little bit. But if you get it close, you know, most people aren't going to notice. But all too often in homebrew, you know, we're pretty far off the mark. And you're pouring the beer and you're getting 3/4 of a glass of foam and having to wait for that to go down and, you know, do all this stuff messing around.
And finally, let's talk about the cleanliness of the systems. I mean, if you've been drinking beer in bars for any extended period of time, you've gotten bad beer because of nastiness in the beer lines.
Yep.
How do we avoid that at home?
Well, clean the lines. Make sure you don't have beer standing in the line. We talked about the fact that these little plastic connectors for the corny kegs come apart. There's a little slot on the top. Put a screwdriver in there. Unscrew that thing. It comes completely apart. The Cobra heads that they're making these days actually unscrew and come apart as well. So you can get completely inside those and clean them. But the main thing is, you know, not having beer in contact with the lines. We know there's yeast still in the beer. We know there's other bugs that, you know, we try to minimize their presence in beer, but they're going to be there. And even at cold temperatures, those things have an opportunity to grow, and they have an opportunity to leave deposits in the lines. As you have deposits in those lines, the resistance changes and the balance is going to change, and so it leads to further problems. So, I, as I said in the talk, like I've been the biggest offender on this in the past myself. You know, you got the chest cooler and you got one hose in there, and you know you tap the beer you want to pour and you pour it, and you know you leave it sitting in there with the door closed. Think, it's in the chiller. You know, cooler.
And somebody says, "Hey, I want some of that one over there."
Yeah, and you move it
and
around.
You don't have the hose on there.
Oh, right. Yeah, you just move it around. But meanwhile, you know, eventually that hose has been in there for months. And if you ever actually do get it empty, you find out that it's not clear anymore.
And that's not iota for staining.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's probably not a good thing. So, you know, getting them, cleaning them with caustic solution is the recommended course of action. In a commercial bar, they say every 2 weeks they ought to be cleaning those lines with caustic. And, you know, that's probably not a bad guideline for homebrew, too, if you're keeping beer in the line on a regular basis. If it's more incidental, if it's more occasional, then certainly you need to be cleaning those lines after every use. That's one thing, you know, that Chicago Beer Society, we do a lot of events. We own a lot of draft equipment, and we're pretty good about cleaning those lines after every event because we know if we don't, then we're just going to replace them before the next event. So,
well, very good. I appreciate your time, Ray.
Yeah, James, glad to do it. See you. Take care.
Well, that was very interesting.
So who knew that that pouring the perfect pint would be so complicated with the math and the pi r squared and
no,
pi r round?
Pi r round, cornbread r square.
So anyway, that's useful stuff. You know, every now and then we get emails from people. My keg system—it's all foam. What do I do? Well, maybe it's the wrong size hose. So take that information to heart. Well, our last interview this episode is our buddy Craig Ballinger from Brew Bubba's.
Hey, Craig,
who was there? And unfortunately, Jerry was not there. Jerry had to work, and he was very sad.
Oh.
So we missed Jerry.
I drank for him.
Oh yeah, we took up his slack.
Yeah,
but Craig was there, not giving a presentation, but he was there. He was talking to me about his new website. There's a new website that they're working on to help people find good craft beer in locations that they've never been. So we talked to Craig for just a minute about craftbeerlocator.com.
Well, Craig, you don't sound like yourself.
Well, I've been screaming all night long, club night last night, and then ended up here in the hospitality suite catching a few more interviews, and it was so loud. I mean, I had to scream. You know how it's like, so I have no voice left. Plus, I came down here with a little bit of a cold, so it's not helping.
So you should have been like old fuddy-duddies Steve and me, and, you know, we went to bed. We were probably asleep by midnight, so, you know, we're getting a little old to be out all night. Are you still a youngster? Is that it?
No, I've got the big 5-0 just a few months ahead of me. So the youngsters, that's in my rearview mirror, James.
Well, let's talk about your website. First of all, remind me of the URL.
It's craftbeerlocator.com. And the whole idea of it was I do a lot of traveling, and I go into towns. Some websites are pretty useful, others aren't. I usually try Google, and sometimes that's successful. Pub crawler sometimes works, but it happened about a year ago. I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I just Googled. The first three that came up in Google, they were closed. And then I went to pub crawler, and two out of the three were closed. So I thought, this is frustrating. I want to get a good beer, have a burger, come home, do a little bit of work, go to bed. That was it. So I said, why doesn't someone have a website? So that sort of spawned the idea of Craft Beer Locator. So I called a guy from our club, works at EDS, pretty techie computer geek, and explained what I was looking to do. And he goes, I can do that. Well, he got in a little bit more than what he bargained for, because that started about a year ago, and I think every spare time for Al has been spent on the website. But the idea is, no matter what town you're in, you could type in the town, click on the state, and it'll sort by what you're looking for. Are you looking to find craft beer? You want to find a brew pub? You want to find a beer bar? We're going to have some other features that will be coming up pretty soon. I don't want to spill all the beans. Officially, we're launching July 1st. But the nice thing about it is the breweries will have their very own web page template. So they can add up their beers, their descriptions. It's not going to be some other description. It's not going to be a rating service. You know, Rate Beer and Beer Advocate do a great job. People want to rate beer, still go to those. We're not to take away any of the hits of those sites. In fact, we're probably going to encourage hits on their sites, because one of the things we're going to be doing is giving all the beer, we're going to call them beer explorers, the beer enthusiasts, give them their own very web page so they can build their own template, and it's going to be all beer related. So they can put whatever beer sites they hit on there, just put it as a template. They can click and it'll hot link right to whatever that site be a Rate Beer or whatever, beer blog, whatever it is that they're into related to beer.
So that way you don't get people trashing restaurants or bars or breweries, or you get information that is reliable and hopefully up to date.
That's exactly right. And we're going to give the brewers are going to have, and the beer stores eventually will have, some tools that will be put into their hands. One of the things we're looking to do is they'll be able to generate an email. It depends on the program, either once a month or four times a month, send out a beer release. We're looking at the possibility of them sending out a text message. So you're sitting at your office at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday, your phone vibrates, you look down, here's your favorite pub, it's a beer release, it's a Belgian triple, 7 o'clock. You're calling your buddies, hey, let's head over there, they're at the release party tonight. So that's the idea that we're looking to do, put a lot of tools into their hands that they don't have, and it would go out within a 25-mile radius, or any other beer enthusiasts that have them as their favorite brewery, they would get that message too. So some people might be willing to drive farther than 25 miles for good beer, so they'd be interested in that information.
Wow. And you get the iPhones with the GPS system in there, and
I'm already eyeing them up. July 11th.
Well, this sounds like it sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a lot of work too.
It has been a lot of work, and to be honest, that's why some of our shows have been a little bit behind. Just been working so hard on this, but it's a project that we thought was important enough to let the show slip a little bit. But we're trying to get back on track, so we'll keep up with everything. Probably go to one Brewbubba podcast per month, but we also want to venture out into talking about Michigan beer. So we're looking at a podcast called The Michigan Beer Scene, and it's just going to focus with 70-some breweries. There's two more opening up before the snow flies in Michigan. It's a great time to be in Michigan for beer, so we're just going to focus on that. We know the audience will be more Michigan-related, but there is a lot of interest around the country in Michigan beer, too. So anybody who wants to listen, obviously, it's just a simple click for a download.
Excellent. So once again, the beer locator site is craftbeerlocator.com?
That is correct.
And is it live now?
If you went there now, it would be a test site. So you're not going to see everything. There's some other features. There's going to be a pub crawl feature. We've already got the module built. It's just got to be loaded. Or you can go in, how many pubs do you want to hit in what geography? And if you have a designated driver, any of the pubs that sign up, the designated driver gets free soft drinks all night. We really want to encourage responsibility. So there's a few things coming, plus a few things that I really can't talk about at this point, but they will be there probably within the next 3-4 months.
Well, excellent. So good luck on the new site.
Well, thank you very much, James. I'm looking forward to it.
Appreciate your time.
Appreciate yours, too. Take care.
Well, again, it was great to talk to Craig in person. I've talked to him on the phone several times and swapped emails with him. I think that Craig, he was recording stuff, too, and he probably got more stuff than we did, really.
Yeah, he was
everywhere.
The hardest working man in show business, I'm telling you.
So check out Brew Bubba's. The Brew Bubba's podcast to see what Craig's up to. And Steve Oatley was shooting video for them again. And Steve, we have to thank Steve for helping us to shoot our stand-up on our Club Night mm-hmm. podcast. It's one of those things where we're a two-man band. You know, I do all the shooting and you do all the interviewing. And when it comes time to get both of us on camera, we need an extra set of hands And Steve was able to help us with that. And also we have to thank Jeff Bear.
That's right.
From Craft Beer Radio, who helped us the night before.
He has a promising new career as a cameraman.
That's right.
In case this computer thing doesn't work out.
That's right. That's right. So next week we're going to talk to Randy Mosher about I'm trying to find the title of his presentation. The Belgium Nobody Knows, and it was such a fascinating topic, and Randy is such an informative, intelligent speaker.
Boy, no kidding.
That we just spent half an hour with him and just said, hey, well, that's a show.
Yep.
So look for that next week. But, Steve, thanks again for coming in and helping us wrap this up.
Thanks, James. I feel like I know everything there is to know about homebrewing.
Everything
there is to know. Maybe not. I need to go to San Francisco next year.
Hey, well, there's the thing. Yeah, the Bay Area. Look out next year.
Oh, no.
Make your plans now because we are planning to be there. So, that's it. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or steve@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on our store, basicbrewingshop.com, where you can see Steve do a single-step decoction mash, and you can follow me through a lager fermentation in the middle of summer, where I don't use a dedicated chest freezer. There are also original DVDs and Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We walk you through the extract brewing process step-by-step from boiling to bottling. And it's been a while since we did that DVD, so you can see both of us probably thinner with more hair. So
it's like what, 3 months ago.
No. And in our second DVD, Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. We got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can see the ever-growing list of fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've got shats, shirts and hats.
We've got shats.
Or the new shat. You can wear that.
Oh, no.
Thanks to everybody who has continued to click on our Amazon.com link on our site. We appreciate the support with that as well. Our featured products this week are Schmetz Jean and Denim Machine Needles, size 14/90, and Ben and Jerry's Homemade Ice Cream and Dessert Book.
Ooh.
So it's always fun to see what people buy. There are tons of people buying beer books
yeah.
and beer-related stuff, but I enjoy seeing the random things that people buy on Amazon.
So, well, this was fun.
Yeah.
We should do this less often. That's my musicians and friends say. Maybe more often.
Well, that's all. Until next week. Steve, you about ready for lunch?
I'm ready for lunch.
Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer.
I'm Steve Wilkes.
Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson down there in Austin. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.
Happy brewing.